Conformal geometry is the study of angle-preserving maps. We can equivalently define conformal geometry as how the metric transforms under coordinate transformations. So it's defined on how the metric tensor transforms under coordinate transformation. And so the transformation is this, which can be viewed as a rotation followed by a local dilation. So at every space-time point, all we're going to see is the metric rotate and dilate. To see that this is equivalent to an angle-preserving map, we can see that the cosine of an angle between two vectors, v and w, can be written like this. And so, if this transformation is conformal, then you can see we're going to pick up a factor of omega in the numerator and two factors of the square root of omega in the denominator. Sorry, there's a cosine prime for the first one. Okay, sure, yeah. This is angle-preserving maps in a Riemannian geometry. So we're just taking this to be an extension of that in when we have time dimensions as well as space dimensions in our manifold. Yeah. I'm defining the cosine of an angle to be this, I suppose. I'm just saying, how would you define an angle in a space-time geometry? Okay, this is how I'm going to do it then. It's an analogy to Riemannian geometry, I suppose. Okay.
Norm of the vector. It's not, it can never be imaginary.
But if omega is negative.
Yeah, I mean, for a time like
No, it could be negative. He's right. Yeah.
But what do you mean? The norm of every vector is a positive number. It doesn't matter what the vector is.
No, it's negative.
It's taking the square root of something. That's something that can be negative, yeah.
No, she's right. If the norm of the vectors are still positive numbers. Or
that's not a norm.
Yeah, but that's not a norm. That's the.
If it's a space like, yes, but it can be the time like,
yeah.
Then it's negative.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's calculate angles between
who cares
like
if that's imaginary.
Vectors.
What if it's null?
There you go.
Then zero.
This is not the important part. I was just trying to rectify by recalling these conformal. We're going to define conformal transformations to be this local transformation of our metric. This is just to give some geometrical insight, which I didn't put that much thought into, I suppose. The conformal group, the Poincaré group, sorry, is the subgroup. Of the conformal group with omega equal to 1. So that's a group that we're all accustomed to dealing with. Okay, so that's just a very short introduction of what a conformal transformation and what the conformal group is. Now let's start trying to deduce the conformal algebra. So let's look at infinitesimal conformal transformations. So let's look at conformal transformations near the identity.
Sorry, so there's another thing.
Yeah.
Do those, the way you define the dot product, it seems that your vectors didn't transform. So
yeah, I've taken them to just be just an element of the tangent space.
Okay. So the tangent space is invariant under.
Well, the point that they're taking transforms.
Okay.
So they're still taken at, yeah, I'm just transporting them to the new point.
No, you're not. You're taking them at the same point.
Well, there's hidden dependencies on space and time here.
I think it should be the same point, x and not x.
But then that wouldn't be a transformation. This isn't really the important part of what I'm doing. Maybe this is only good for Euclidean or Riemannian geometry.
Actually, I think also in the definition of conformal transformations, it should be the new metric at the point x and not the new metric at the point x prime. I know it's like this in my previous notes. But
I think it's at the new space-time point that you do that at. I could check.
Okay, I don't insist.
The in Di Francesco's book, it's the new space-time point as well.
I know.
Okay, maybe.
It's what Raoul was telling us, that it's wrong in Di Francesco.
So, sorry, Anton. I don't know. I just copy-pasted that equation from a book. That's not like that. I was just to give a geometrical reasoning why we're calling these conformal.
Sure.
Okay. We could look at this again. Okay, so let's look at infinitesimally small conformal transformations. So in these transformations, our space-time coordinates will move by some infinitely small translation epsilon, and our metric components will transform as a 0-2 tensor. All right. So the conformal requirement reads that, the Minkowski metric if we took our G initially was Minkowski because we're looking at the infinitely small transformations, we're looking at the identity, and we have this transformation. This implies that delta mu eta nu plus, partial mu eta nu is equal to some function multiplied by the Minkowski metric, where f of x is equal to 1 minus omega x. I'm going to call this equation dagger. And if we contract dagger, with the Minkowski metric, with upstairs indices, we get that f of x is determined by our number of dimensions and the infinitesimal translation. So we're going to do a little bit of manipulation to find out what our epsilon transformation or translations can be. By acting on dagger with d rho, and permuting a linear combination of, or any linear combination of permutations of their indices, we can find that we have this expression for epsilon. And then I call this double dagger. This equation is going to be important in finding what epsilon can be as well. So if we contract with the Minkowski metric and apply partial sigma, we get 2 minus d, partial sigma partial f, is equal to 2 del squared del sigma epsilon rho. Keeping this equation in mind, we could apply del squared to dagger, and we get, don't worry, this is getting somewhere soon. Expression, and we can relate this to the this equation to get in terms of f, get 1/2 2 minus d partial mu partial nu f plus 2 minus d again partial nu partial mu of f, partial derivatives commute, and we get 2 minus d partial mu, partial nu, f. All right, if we contract with the Minkowski metric once again, we get this expression for the, I guess it's the Laplacian in Euclidean coordinates, but the box operator in space-time, yeah?
Would any of this be different if we use a general metric?
A general metric?
Yeah, instead of the Minkowski metric.
We are using a general metric. We're only doing it near the identity, near the Minkowski metric.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering about that too. You're doing infinitesimally small conformal transformations, but or coordinate transformations, but that can happen like, on any manifold.
Yeah, I suppose.
And this all probably does follow. If you use
I think you're right. I think these can all be.
You might as well choose a simple example, and you can still drive everything.
We can do this around all the G's as well.
Nothing we ever used.
Yeah. Well, we commuted a partial through the metric, but if we had covariant rules, then it'd be fine. So, I think just using NMU new is choosing an easy example. Okay. That's all.
That's a good point, though. Yeah. Okay.
Can you just read what you wrote up there?
Sure.
Apply d squared
to the dagger equation over there. Sorry. And then, can you read the rest, or I could read it out?
No.
Okay. Okay, so we get this equation, which implies that 1 minus d times del squared of f is 0. So in one dimension, this means that any smooth transformation is a conformal transformation, or f just has to be smooth, and this transformation is conformal. In two dimensions, we come to a special case that's not shared with the other dimensions, and it is a topic of much interest. But we're going to work with when d is greater than or equal to 3, we have that this is 0. This is true for two dimensions as well, but using that equation over there, we find that all second derivatives of f vanish. This means that all partials of f are constant. And so by using double dagger, we come to the fact that all second partials are all double derivatives of epsilon are constant. And this just shows that our epsilon must be at most quadratic.
Sorry, I pulled a bit behind.
Okay.
So at that double dagger equation, there's some terms that's too many U's and too many U's.
Oh, you're right. There you go. Okay, so now that we know what the general polynomial form of epsilon can be, we can start finding out what the generators are. So our epsilon has to be a translation plus this form that looks like a rotation, but is in fact going to encapsulate our dilations as well, and another term that's used for conformal transformations. So as you can see, we could choose the latter two indices of C to be symmetric, since it only comes in as a product with another symmetric term. So if we substitute that equation called star into our equation for dagger, and setting x equals 0, we get 2 over d trace of e as our metric is equal to well, it's proportional anyway to the symmetric part of B. So by separating B into its symmetric and antisymmetric parts, we see that the antisymmetric part has no restrictions, and we could write B more generally as proportionality, or the symmetric part's proportional to the metric, and we have an antisymmetric part. So we could recognize the m's as a infinitesimal rotation and the betas as our dilations. And then by looking at our quadratic terms and substituting into double dagger, we can get that simpler form for the coefficients of our quadratic terms. Where B is going to be this. The chalk. Okay, and so the quadratic transformations
C mu nu rho is symmetric on mu nu or nu rho?
Nu rho. Yeah, that's off, isn't it? Yeah, whoops. So our quadratic transformation looks like this.
this term?
Where this extra term is only for cosmetic reasons, since it's going to, if we take the inner product of x prime with itself, you're going to get 1 over this term. This is known as a special conformal transformation. So now we have a set of transformations and their effects. I'm just going to write a little table of what we have so far. So we have a translation. And it looks like this. And the conformal factor is 1. It's just a subgroup of our Poincaré group. We have dilations. This looks like it has a conformal factor of 1 minus 2 beta, which can be written to first order as 1 over beta plus 1 squared. We have rotations, or in the case of pseudo-Riemannian geometries, Lorentz transformations. And they have this form. And their conformal factor is again 1. And we have special conformal transformations. And they have conformal factor 1 minus 2 b dot x plus b squared, x squared, squared. All right, so this is our conformal transformations. So now that we've decomposed the infinitesimal transformations into a bunch of parts, we're going to start looking at the conformal algebra. My x prime.
You have two terms that are the same, or?
Oh yeah, I do. It was derived from a line before. Yeah, it comes in as twice that term, but you're right. There's two of them. So let's start finding what the conformal algebra is. So if we look at infinitely small conformal transformations on a conformally invariant field, we can write it as Lie algebra generator multiplied by some parameter on our field is going to give us our field, because we said it's conformally invariant. which can be written or expanded about x naught, x prime. And this equation is going to allow us to identify our generators as differential operators on our space of quintiformally invariant fields. So this is just a general statement of how to find or how to associate your Lie algebra elements with differential operators. So we have, for translation, our p mu is going to be equal to negative I partial mu. Our dilation, d, is going to be equal to negative I times x mu del mu. Our rotation is going to be this form. And special conformal transformations are going to be this not so familiar form. This is going to completely determine the conformal algebra. So a lot of this algebra is just taken straight from the Poincaré group, or algebra. Except for the terms involving K and D, our special conformal transformations, and the dilation operator. Turns out that this space is isometric or isomorphic to the conformal, the algebra for a Poincaré algebra or a Lorentz algebra in a higher space. So we'll see that exactly. So if we have p time dimensions and q space dimensions, then the conformal algebra is equivalent to SO Q plus 1 P plus 1 with the association that I'm going to define here. Our space-time components from 0 to d minus 1 will just be the Lorentz components we had already. I'm going to define a minus 1 component as the minus 1 d component as the dilation operator. The minus 1 mu component as a combination of our translations and special conformal maps. And the d mu component is going to be another linear combination. And J has the SO Q plus 1 P plus 1 algebra. Where mu can be anything from negative 1 to d. All right, so now we could go on to representations of the conformal group. Any questions? So we're interested in how these generators act on fields. We're acting on how the fields transform under the generations of the conformal group. So the subgroup of the conformal group leaving the origin invariant is generated by our rotations, dilations, and special conformal maps, but our translations moves the identity, if we acted on a field at the identity. So we will denote the values of these operators by S delta and kappa when they act on a field at the identity. And so if we have a multi-component field, then these are just going to be matrices because they're just a field at a point. So using the commutation relations and use of the Hausdorff formula, we have a few identities of how to translate these operators. So that would be, for instance, if you did Lorentz transformation on a field
at
zero,
origin.
At the origin. So yeah, oh, that's the identity.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Okay, so using the commutation rules, we can deduce how these operators are translated. By space-time coordinate x. Right, and the momentum operator is left invariant because it commutes with the other momentum operators. So this determines how our fields transform under conformal transformations uniquely.
Can I just say something?
Sure.
My understanding is that, so your first deriving or saying how a field transforms at the origin, because these are the transformations which leave the origin invariant.
There are transformations that, when done on the field, it doesn't move the origin.
Right.
So it would move the inner space-time points, rotations would move them around.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're using these formulae to kind of move them around? Or?
Yeah, I'm going to use these formulae to find out how these operators act on the field at different points, yeah.
Right.
So you're gonna translate it. So let's say we act on that with operator phi p, phi at a point x. Sorry, it's gonna translate it back to the origin, and then we know how it works, and then translate it back. So we find that our translation operator acts on it as we would expect. We can find how the other operators act on other fields. Now I'm using the forms of our generators that are at the identity, at the origin, sorry.
Is that S or?
Yeah, it's S here. Is that the S you're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Our dilation operator. does that. And our special conformal transformation is actually more complicated.
Remind me what S is. S is L, but at the origin?
Yes. L at the origin is the same thing as S at the origin. So it's S is only defined to act on fields at the origin, as is our delta hat and kappa.
What does it mean that when you have S acting on phi, on phi x?
S acting on phi of x?
Yeah.
We never defined it.
Right, because this expression, it gives you zero, right? If I put x close to zero.
I don't know.
The expression for L over here,
mm-hmm.
If I put x mu equals to zero, x mu equals to, is that, I'm doing something like this, then that just gives me, that gives me zero, right? What about the derivative?
I see what you're asking. I don't know why it's not zero, though.
Well, I mean, S would be a non-trivial operator, presumably. That's what I'm asking.
Oh.
But according to this formula.
Yeah, okay. That's exactly what it is. That's the contribution that's you're gonna get when you move away from the origin. But at zero, you're gonna have a normal, like, because if we're looking at the field that transforms under the Poincaré group, the S is going to be our spin matrix. If phi is going to be 2j plus 1 dimensional spinner.
Oh, I see.
So it's just the form of the operator, how it behaves at the origin, at the identity, no, origin. This can all get quite convoluted at times. L acting at zero is going to be S acting at phi of zero, and that's non-trivial. If you put in zero into this, it's all going to turn out to be what we were expecting. So setting X to zero should get us on the right-hand sides S, delta hat, and kappa. And it does. That's good. Okay. All right. So now we're going to put our attention on to fields that transform under irreducible representations of the Lorentz group.
What's the first one to go? Wheel?
We restrict?
No, no. So
right.
The thing before that.
If.
Ah. Thanks.
If we restrict our attention to fields belonging to irreducible representations of the Lorentz group, then the fact that our delta hat operator commutes with the Lorentz generator, we have by Schur's law that the delta hat operator will be proportional to the unit matrix. And I'm going to define the proportionality constant to be I delta. And it can be shown that delta is real. And that's going to correspond to our scaling constant. So,
a quick question.
Yeah.
Now that I'm reading the boards over here.
Sure.
So you've got up there that like just the expression there is k mu plus 2 x mu. Something that I thought was a D, but now I think is an abla with a hat on it, perhaps, because that's what you wrote down here. Like
that's a D.
It's a D.
Oh.
What, they just don't match. And I don't know if I should expect them to match, but.
No, they don't match.
Okay.
It's a D, and that's delta.
Okay.
That this is general for any spacetime point. And this is acting specifically
acting on
at
the origin, right? So you substituted delta for D
because it's acting at the origin.
Okay, cool.
The reason why we do that, I know it just seems like we're doing a pointless substitution, but the point is that when we're actually doing these calculations, if we're on a finite dimensional representation, these are going to be matrices,
okay,
not operators that are infinite dimensional.
So
it's also D. It's D if it acted on,
right. D
at zero.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's all I was wondering.
Yeah. All right. So we are interested in fields that transform in a special way.
You said something about Schur's dilemma.
Yeah. This is zero. If our group is generated by those operators, any operator commuting with all the, if it commutes with the algebra.
So there's so many algebras here, I'm getting confused.
Okay.
So you
have
to say which algebra, which operators.
Right. So if we look at just the irreducible representation of the Lorentz group, that's generated by our S generators. Schur's lemma says that if a operator commutes with the algebra, then it has to be a multiple of the identity. Okay. Sorry, I'm probably going quite quickly.
No, I'm just slow.
No, that's not true.
No, so a question then. I mean, you had this relation originally in the conformal algebra. You had D L mu nu commutated as zero.
D L mu nu, yeah, yeah.
So does it hold for D as well?
For D?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it
so
does.
I'm just asking why.
But we're looking at only at the Lorentz group, so we're not looking at translations at all. But it is, I may go on the line and say that it might be true for the Poincaré group that D is also multiple of the identity in the Poincaré group. Although that's not true because it doesn't commute with translations, so it wouldn't actually be. So we're interested in fields that transform by a scaling. Any field that transforms in this way is called quasi-primary.
Is that omega of x to the power half or?
Half, yeah. Omega of x to the power of delta over 2.
Delta over 2?
Yeah. So delta is a scaling factor. An example of these quasi-primary fields are any spinless field.
Which transformations are included there? All dilations, translations, special conformal.
Here?
Yeah.
Which transformations do these correspond to?
Yeah, which ones are you including? Are you including all of them? Like,
I think in this one it includes all of them.
Even translations?
Even dilations,
I think so.
Right?
I think it's more than just dilations, isn't it? Maybe it's just dilations. I think it's all conformal transformations.
It's just that omega would probably be trivial for anything other than dilations.
And special conformal methods. But yeah, if this was just a rotation or a translation, then it wouldn't change the field. So I guess all quasi-primary operators don't change under those transformations. All right. So if we look at unitary irreducible representations of quasi-primary fields, then we can get something pretty useful. So we're no longer looking at just the Lorentz irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. So let I delta be any eigenvalue of D. Recall that our commutation relations of D with our special conformal transformation was proportional to the special conformal transformation. And similarly with translation, we had this. This means that our special conformal transformations and our translations act as lowering and raising operators for D respectively. And it so happens that for quasi-primary operators, always have a lowest value for delta, whose value is determined by the dimension of the spin. So the K mu's annihilate.
What's the dimension of the spin?
I think that's the dimension of the irreducible representation that we're using. So you take an irreducible representation, it's going to have some finite dimension of spin, and then our scaling constant is going to have some minimum value for that representation.
So say you have spin half.
Then the dimension of the representation is 2. I don't know what delta is in that case. I think it might also depend on how your fields behave as well under the algebra. And then we can organize the spectrum of the operators of the conformal group based on how the translation operator acts on it. So we form multiplets of the fields with the translation operator. And in some representations, it could also be that several fields get annihilated by the special conformal transformation. And so you have several multiplets of these. And so that's how these fields are organized with quasi-primary fields. Yeah?
Is there like a geometric picture behind this? I mean, I can follow the mathematics, but translation operators, you're interpreting that as a lowering, as a raising operator, right?
As a raising operator of our dilation.
So, I mean, doesn't the translation operator just move things around? I mean, just translate the whole field as a general, and I just don't. And how does that raise the eigenvalue? I mean, is there like a geometrical?
So
classical picture.
I can show you why it raises the eigenvalue algebraically.
No, I mean algebraically,
okay.
I can see.
Okay. Yeah. This surprised me as well, actually. I haven't had time to think about what this means geometrically. It does seem strange that the translation operator will change.
But can it be something like, if you have a field and then you add a derivative from the field, the dimension of this is the dimension is changed because you have the derivative. And it's only by dimensional analysis.
I see.
I think it's something related with the image.
No.
Which I don't have a geometric picture for you.
I think there might be something related.
Okay.
All
right. So this is everything I've done for this lecture. It'll continue next week, I think, starting with the angular or the stress energy tensor, I believe, and then on. Okay. Are there any more questions? All right.